Did you know that CFRC 101.9 FM also has social media? Check us out on Twitter at CFRC for the latest program and news updates.
It's 2 o'clock, and you're listening to CFRC, 101.9 FM, CFRC.ca. It's time for Swing, Swang, Swung. 2 hours of jazz coming your way. My name is Dave. I'm here right up till 4 o'clock playing all kinds of different music. Brought a bunch of stuff from home. There's still a real nice selection of Canadian jazz that's come into the station over the last few months that we'll play a little bit later in the show. But to start today's show off, we're going to talk to Gordon Duick, a professor from the history department, who's presenting a lecture next week on the cultural history of Kingston. So we'll get into that in just a minute. But to set the mood, let's listen to some music from Will Marion Cook and Rick Benjamin and the Paragon Ragtime Orchestra. This is the overture to a play called In Da Homie. Kicking off Swing, Swang, Swung.
Thank you.
Music from 1903 from William, Mary, and Cook, and the Overture to In Dahomey. Kicking off Swing, Swang, Swung this week. Joined in the studio by Gordon Duick from the History Department here at Queen's University. And he is giving a talk next week, a public lecture at the library on the cultural history of Kingston, focusing on minstrel shows and the blackface phenomena of 150 years ago. Welcome to studio. Thanks for coming in again, Gordon. Always fun.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you tell me a little bit about that piece of music?
Well, that piece of music was written by Will Marion Cook, who was born in Washington, middle-class black family, like Duke Ellington was. And he was trained formally as a musician. He was interested in classical music, but there wasn't much room for him in classical music because he was black. He did study in Berlin at one point. He also studied in New York City under Dvorak, of all people. And Dvorak encouraged him to seek out and develop on folk melodies from black history. So that's what Will Marion Cook did. And because there wasn't much room for him in the classical music world, he turned to musical theater. So this is where In Dahomey comes from. This is the first all-black musical on Broadway. So he did all the music for this. The reason why we're playing this today is because there was a person from Kingston, a black man from Kingston, whose name is George Hammond, who had two parts in this Broadway musical.
Oh, okay. And what happens on Broadway eventually goes on tour and makes its way to Kingston.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that George Hammond had moved to Kingston in 1902, just the year before he went on Broadway. Oh, wow. He had been, I don't know exactly when he left Cuba, but he's actually a Cuban who, when he was around 18, comes to New York City and starts singing there in Harlem and other places, Brooklyn, and he actually tours Britain in the 1890s with another black a minstrel group called the Octoroons. And so he already had, by the time he came to Kingston, he was already, you know, he was a very young man in his 20s, but he was already a veteran of the stage. And when he came to Kingston, he did a lot. He was here maybe 10 years, but he accomplished more, I think, than most people do in their lifetime. In short order, he bought a hotel so that traveling black musicians would be guaranteed a place to stay overnight. That was a problem at the time. And he also was the singer at the first movie theater. The first Nickelodeon in Kingston was the Wonderland, opened in 1907. He was the first singer and the manager of that joint, and he went on to manage the Princess Theater, and he eventually owned that theater. And he also had at least two steamboats that he ran. He was a very accomplished guy and very ambitious. He ran his own tourism business, a cruise. He had cruise ships to Gananoque and to Kingston Mills. And he also had a chicken farm on Wolf Island. He left Kingston in 1910, 1911 to go out west. He started singing in the theaters of Edmonton. But for about 10 years he was here, and he was, one of the most important parts of Kingston's entertainment scene.
A real force. It's wild. And that's your main focus, right? The cultural history of Kingston.
Yeah,
this is just one facet of what you're exploring.
That's right. I teach a course called Kingston Cultural History, and he's one part of it. I deal with the rise of the Nickelodeons, but also going way back to early popular music. And yes, Kingston was a town, just like every other town on the border and in the United States, interested in blackface minstrelsy. So that's one of the ironies is what I discovered is that as early as 1830, white Kingstonians were performing in blackface.
That far back?
Yeah, and it only started in the 1820s. So this is pretty early adoption of that tradition. What I find interesting is that it's always considered an American phenomenon, but I've discovered it's also a Canadian phenomenon. Mm. And but the irony in something I had to really, you know, I had difficulty comprehending at first was why would black people engage in this tradition, which is really about making fun of black people, and how, you know, it's basically these were stories that were told in song, on stage, in plays about, you know, slave life and happy slaves on the plantation. But what's interesting about Indahome, so by around, you know, by the time that George Hammond's involved in this blackface, and he may have worn blackface himself, I don't have any pictures, but it's likely. But by 1903, when he's Indahome, this is a parody of a Back to Africa colonization scheme. This is not set on the plantation. This is far more sophisticated, just as the music we heard is far more sophisticated than normal, you know, Camptown races 5 miles long kind of stuff. This is classically infused. Sometimes we would call it opera as well. Mm-hmm. So they're using classical forms of music and also changing the stories that they're telling and subverting the minstrel form while keeping some of the tropes there to keep, you know, middle class white people happy.
So where were these shows happening in Kingston back at that time? Where were the theaters located? Like along Princess Street?
Or? The theaters would be happening at the Grand. They would be happening at the Nickelodeons. There were at least four Nickelodeons downtown. We had a theater district, but they were also happening in the military. They're happening on the campus at RMC. They had an annual blackface show from 1880 to 1926, and then they revived it in the 1930s. These shows were also happening at the lunatic asylum, is what they call it, the hospital at Rockwood. It was considered to be a form of musical therapy to get the inmates and their keepers involved in blackface shows. They held multiple shows a year.
It's so hard to wrap your head around, man.
I know, it's crazy. And also in the churches, St. George's, there would be people, like men dressing in drag as in blackface. You know, you could go to high tea at St. Andrew's Church to hear white women, coon shouting is what they called it. There was no aspect of Kingston history, Kingston society, that was untouched by blackface. And it's just something that's been, I think, deliberately put under the rug.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's cringy and embarrassing, man. It's hard to...
Yes, it is cringy and embarrassing. But I did, you know, by studying these black... And there's at least four musicians that I've uncovered, discovered from reading old newspapers, that they all had to participate in one way or the other, but they were also... this is kind of like it was an unspoken rule or unwritten rule that a black person who wanted to get into showbiz had to partake of the blackface tradition. And it wasn't but it wasn't the 20th century, and Indahome's part of the turn where the black musicians start to subvert that minstrel form, and fewer of them wear blackface. So by the time you get to like Mr. Bojangles, Bill Robinson, mm-hmm. he's not wearing blackface. So it's the 20s and the 30s where blackface starts to be phased out professionally, but that's when the amateurs came in. The amateurs, the schools, the Rotary clubs, the Kiwanis clubs, it never went away. In fact, I saw 1972, I found a picture of children in a Catholic school here in Kingston putting on blackface for their show. In 1968, there was another Catholic school that, just in the wake of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., had a meeting to discuss whether they should go forward with their minstrel show. And they went forward with it, kept the songs like Camptown Races and Way Down Upon the Suwannee River, But instead of wearing blackface, they wore clown face instead. This is how old this tradition is, and I'm surprised that no historian has ever mentioned it. I think the historians, as much as my theory, would rather think of, you know, when we talk about the Grand Opera House, they would rather talk about the Grand Opera rather than the actual popular stuff. People didn't go there. You know, some people might have enjoyed the Shakespeare, but if you really wanted to raise money for a good cause or make a profit, you put on a minstrel show.
Wild. Hey, let's play a little bit more music.
Sure.
This is also from In Da Homie. This track is a William Marion Cook composition called Swing Along. Yeah, it's beautiful music from William Marion Cook. That's Swing Along from an album called Black Manhattan. Gordon Duick from the History Department at Queen's University is here in studio with us today. He's talking a little bit about the phenomena of minstrel shows and blackface and how it was part of the Kingston cultural community 100 years, 150 years,
well, I gotta
200
tell you,
years ago.
It started in like 1830 in Kingston. In New York City, it started around 1828. So it quickly moved across the border. Whatever happened in New York City, it would happen very quickly, a year or two later in Kingston. We forget that we're a border town. Mm. We have our name, the King's Town. We have Prince's Street. We have the Royal Military College. We have Queen's University. But this is an American town, too. We forget how porous the cultural border was between New York City and Kingston. You know, the people who could afford it in Kingston, the elites, where would they summer? They would go to New York, that sort of thing. The cultural ties between New York City and Kingston go all the way back to, you know, 1783 and the Loyalists coming over. And who did the Loyalists bring with them? They brought their black slaves. So we already had a black population in the 18th century. And one of the things I'm doing in my course is just reminding white Kingstonians that this, despite, you know, the fact that our black community is smaller now than it used to be, they were always part of the cultural fabric of the city.
So if people are interested in this and want to hear the full talk, where, when, how do they find you next week?
It's going to be at the Public Library on Johnson Street, the Central Public Library, at 2 p.m., I can't remember which room it is, but it'll be easy to find. And I don't know how long it'll be, but I'll try to keep it down to 45 minutes to an hour. I'll be playing, hopefully you'll have time to play some of this music. But most of the time I'll be talking about four black musicians. Their names are Daniel Riley. He emerges around the 1850s. And then there's Fred Cosby, or Crosby, depending on his mood. Well, you know, that was his stage name, was Crosby. He wanted to sound more Irish. He was an interesting fellow. And also, Clarence Jones. And finally, George Hammond, the one who was in this Broadway musical that we've been playing music from. Clarence Jones and George Hammond knew each other. They both married girls from Wolf Island. And they also performed at Lake Ontario Park. Lake Ontario Park, this is an interesting thing I think I should. One of the things I discovered for this course, or include in the course because it's wild, Lake Ontario Park, which is a much beloved memory for a lot of Kingstonians, this goes back to the 1890s when there was an electric streetcar company. The electric streetcar company was founded by the a guy named Ben Folger, and he was American as well. The Folger family were an American family from Cape Vincent who were the prime movers behind most of the mass transportation in this town. They owned the steamboats. They owned the cruise ship lines that went through the Thousand Islands. They owned the K&P Railway. They had stakes in all these railways, including the streetcar company. And the streetcar company, as soon as it was founded, bought Lake Ontario Park, or leased it, and created an amusement park there. And that was where the streetcar company turned around. And
on the end of the line.
It was at the end of the line. This is really smart marketing on their part. And this was like a model that North American streetcar companies had, a business model. What you do is you most of your money in the morning and in the early afternoon or late afternoon are for the workers. Okay, they're going to work and they're coming back from work. What do you do the rest of the time? How do you get the wives and the children onto the streetcar during the week, during the middle of the day, or on the weekend, on Saturday? You have an amusement park and picnic grounds at Lake Ontario Park. And there was a pavilion there where they showed movies and blackface and, of course, vaudeville. Vaudeville and blackface were integrated at a certain point. But what's interesting, I find interesting, just from a historian's point of view, is how the same people who were in charge of mass transport were also the ones involved in mass entertainment.
Fascinating stuff, man.
And I'll be talking about that and more at 2 p.m. on Saturday at the Central Public Library on Johnson Street.
I find this stuff endlessly fascinating. Thank you so much for coming in, giving us just a little bit of a taste of it. Can't wait to hear more at the lecture next weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to play a little piece of music from James Reese Europe to close out. Another incredible, often overlooked composer and performer from that era. This is called Hey There, Hi There.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic, every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.
Colon cancer is the number two killer of all cancers. It can affect anyone. But with early detection, the survival rate is estimated at 90%. The key? A simple test you do in your own home.
I'm Ann Murray, and I lost a very dear friend to colon cancer. He was 49, and had he been tested, he might still be with us. Talk to your doctor. Get your test. Not knowing is not the answer.
For more information or to donate, visit coloncancercanada.ca. Colon Cancer Canada. We're behind, you're behind.
I mean the jeebie, talking about the daddy heebie-jeebie. You see all the girls and boys do out deep up the dip dip joy. Hey, don't you know it? Deep up deep up, dumb being blue. Someone to teach you, come on and do that dance. They call the heebie-jeebie dance. Yes, sir. They got the pop, they got the heebie-jeebies bad.
That's brand new music from Wynton Marsalis. He's still fascinated by music from 100 years ago as well. He just put out a new disc that's a tribute to the music of Louis Armstrong. So we'll be playing more of that in the weeks to come. That was, of course, the Heebie Jeebies. Before that, Kid Ory and the Dippermouth Blues from, I'm going to say the late 1920s, maybe early 30s. But just how quickly the music changed in the early part of the 20th century. It was a very, very dynamic period in the cultural history of North America, and Kingston was a fine example of it. So if you're interested in learning more about that, Professor Duick will be presenting his conversation next week at the Kingston Public Library. 2 o'clock is the time for that. So check that out. Want to play more music? This is called Amsterdam After Dark. Brand new music from Ingrid Jensen on Swing Swang Swung. Thank you.
George Coleman! George Coleman!
Thank you.